From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. I'm recording this podcast on Monday, January 13th. I've chosen three articles to review this morning. One is a really wonderful state-of-the-art review on peripartum cardiomyopathy published in JACC. The second, an interesting article from the EMPA-REG outcome trial looking at the influence of hypoglycemia and future risk. And then in a related topic, I suppose, the updated ESC guidelines on diabetes, prediabetes, and cardiovascular diseases. So let's start with peripartum cardiomyopathy. This is obviously a very important problem. It is an idiopathic condition of the left ventricle, and it typically occurs toward the end of pregnancy or after delivery. In the United States, the incidence varies from between 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 4,000, and there are risk factors that can be identified, including African ancestry, preeclampsia and hypertension, multifetal pregnancies, and older maternal age. The etiology for this is poorly understood. Existing studies suggest that it might be a vascular disease, perhaps triggered by peripartum hormonal changes, with prolactin breakdown products having vasculotoxic effects. Genetic studies have identified pathogenic variants in the Titin gene in afflicted patients, supporting potentially a two-hit hypothesis. The diagnosis is often delayed as symptoms can overlap with those of a normal pregnancy. And of course, an echocardiogram is typically needed for the diagnosis. And one should carefully look for intracardiac thrombi when the EF is severely reduced because of a high risk of thromboembolism. Predictors of adverse outcomes include the level of EF reduction at the time of diagnosis, with, of course, lower EF being worse, and for African ancestry, obesity, preeclampsia, LV dilation, RV dilation, and systolic dysfunction, and LV thrombus are all predictors of worse prognosis. Compared to other cardiomyopathies, however, peripartum cardiomyopathy is associated with a higher rate of recovery, and it can occur late as 2 years. The management has to think about fetal safety. During pregnancy and lactation, loop diuretics, beta blockers, digoxin, hydralazine nitrates can be used. Renin, angiotensin, aldo inhibitors are contraindicated during pregnancy, but during lactation, enalapril, captopril, and spironolactone can be used. What about anticoagulation? The use is endorsed by the guideline committees if the EF is less than 30% during late pregnancy and up to 8 weeks postpartum. As you know, warfarin is relatively contraindicated during pregnancy, but low molecular weight heparin can be used, and both of these agents are safe during lactation. The novel oral anticoagulants have not been studied extensively during pregnancy and are currently thought to be best avoided. The role of bromocriptine as a therapeutic agent is currently considered experimental. If used, therapeutic anticoagulation is recommended because it is prothrombotic and it suppresses lactation. Peripartum cardiomyopathy is the most common cause of cardiogenic shock during or shortly after pregnancy. Nitroprusside should be avoided due to cyanide toxicity, and outcomes can be worse with dobutamine. Temporary mechanical support has been used successfully and should be considered. When necessary, cardiac transplant in this population is associated with higher rejection rates and lower survival. Early delivery or termination of pregnancy should be considered in cases of hemodynamic instability. Stable patients generally are delivered vaginally unless there's an obstetrical reason for a C-section. And postpartum risk of decompensation should be anticipated. Since prolactin has been implicated in the pathogenesis, the 2010 European guidelines on this advised against breastfeeding. However, in a small U.S. study and data from other observational registries, there's been a suggestion that breastfeeding is safe. So this continues to be debated. The data for risk on arrhythmias is conflicted, but is reasonable to consider wearing a wearable defibrillator in women who have new onset peripartum cardiomyopathy and severe LV dysfunction until either recovery or an ICD might be indicated based on time. Contraception should be discussed extensively with women who suffer peripartum cardiomyopathy. Progesterone-releasing subcutaneous implants or intrauterine devices are the first-line choices, and estrogen should generally be avoided. If LV dysfunction persists, medications should be continued indefinitely. In women who have LV recovery, the observational data would suggest continuing indefinitely. If heart failure medications are stopped, they should be weaned in a stepwise manner and then subsequent clinical and echocardiographic assessments performed. Obviously, appropriate counseling on patients considering an additional pregnancy should be robust. If LV dysfunction persists, women probably should be counseled that there's much worse in maternal and fetal outcomes. Women who recover to an EF greater than 50% still have an increased risk of heart failure with a subsequent pregnancy. And women who do have a subsequent pregnancy should be followed very closely with serial clinical assessments, echoes, and BNP levels from contraception until after delivery. And recall that ACE inhibitors, ARBs, and ALDO antagonists should be discontinued prior to conception and then restarted after delivery. What a great review of a complex topic, peripartum cardiomyopathy. I hope these key learning points are useful to you. Second article I want to talk about briefly is a study that looked at the relationship between hypoglycemia episodes and cardiovascular outcomes that were part of the EMPA-REG outcome clinical trial. You remember this was a study of patients with type 2 diabetes. There were 7,000 of them enrolled. They had hemoglobins between 7 and 10%, and they were randomized to either empagliflozin, 10 to 25 milligrams, or placebo, and followed for 3 years. This particular analysis, which was published this week in the European Heart Journal, asked the question, if patients had episodes of hypoglycemia during the 3 years of follow-up, what was the relationship between that and subsequent outcomes, particularly cardiovascular death or heart failure hospitalizations? And it was very interesting. In a multivariable analysis, hypoglycemia occurred in 28% of patients in each group, and it was associated with an increased risk of heart failure hospitalizations with a hazard ratio of about 1.9, and also an increased risk of myocardial infarction with a hazard ratio of nearly 1.6. Empagliflozin improved cardiovascular outcomes regardless of the occurrence of hypoglycemia and was not a predictor of hypoglycemia in this study. This is an important observation from a clinical trial that episodes of hypoglycemia in our patients appear to identify a group of individuals at much higher risk for subsequent heart failure hospitalizations and cardiovascular events, including MI. The exact mechanism for this are not known at this point, but clearly this is an indicator that we should use in our practice as we monitor our patients and risk stratify. I'm going to finish then with a few key points from the ESC guidelines on diabetes, prediabetes, and cardiovascular diseases, and these were just published. Obviously, you're aware that we should follow our patients and watch for diabetes using fasting glucose or hemoglobin A1C. Routine assessment of microalbuminuria should be carried out to identify patients with renal dysfunction. And of course, our diabetics probably deserve a resting echocardiogram at some point to assess for LV function. Obviously, lifestyle changes are huge in our diabetic patients, and that includes a Mediterranean diet and moderate to vigorous physical activity. Current glucose control targets are something, hemoglobin A1C around or below 7%, and these over time will reduce microvascular complications of diabetes. Tighter control in younger patients seems to reduce cardiovascular events over a 20-year timescale, but less rigorous targets are probably appropriate in the elderly, where the risk of hypoglycemia might be particularly troublesome. And the blood pressure goal, according to the European guideline, is a systolic less than or equal to 130 and a diastolic of less than or equal to 80. The European guidelines argue against not getting the diastolic level below 70. And in the older individuals, the European guidelines suggest a systolic range of 130 to 139 as being reasonable. Clearly, the evidence supports the inclusion of an ACE inhibitor or an ARB in patients who have diabetes, and obviously multi-drug therapy is usually recommended. In pre-diabetics, the risk of new onset diabetes is lower with the renin-angiotensin receptor blockers than beta blockers or diuretics. Obviously, statins are a very important part of the treatment for these individuals. If we look at the effects of reducing risk in diabetes, getting the A1C to goal, the systolic pressure to goal, and the lipids to goal reduces cardiovascular events by 75%. Unbelievable. And in the recent era, the SGLT2 inhibitors and the GLP-1 receptor agonists are taking on a more and more important role. So the SGLT2 inhibitors like empagliflozin, canagliflozin, and dapagliflozin reduce cardiovascular events in patients with diabetes and cardiovascular disease. And similarly, liraglutide, semaglutide, and dulaglutide reduce cardiovascular events in patients with diabetes, particularly those at high CV risk. Increasingly, there are potentially new combinations of antithrombotic drugs. In high-risk patients, there's some suggestion that a combination of low-dose rivaroxaban and aspirin may be beneficial for CAD. And there's some thought that aspirin and reduced-dose ticagrelor might be considered for patients within 3 years of an MI. Remember that in diabetics with multivessel CAD in general, the data suggest that bypass is preferable to PCI. The coexistence of diabetes and heart failure, this is a very high-risk group of patients, and guideline-based medical treatment in these people are particularly important. Remember that renal dysfunction and hyperkalemia are more prevalent, and so the diabetics, we have to think about dose adjustments. First-line treatment of diabetes with heart failure now should include metformin and the SGLT2 inhibitors. So I think this is a really excellent review of diabetes and prediabetes and the relationships to cardiovascular disease and risk, and I recommend that review to you. I want to also point out that if you go to acc.org this week, we are featuring a four-part series called Acute Coronary Syndrome in an Older Adult with Recent or Ongoing Cancer Treatment. And this is a collaborative effort from experts from our geriatric, interventional, and cardio-oncology clinicians based on a couple of cases that outline some of the very interesting interfaces between cardiovascular disease and oncological therapy. Well, I've covered a lot of ground in a short time. I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your cardiovascular update from acc.org, and you can find the articles and the key points and journal scans on the website. I really appreciate your listening to me, and I'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Thank you.